Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Bindler. Chapter 15. Ingleby Strikes It Rich. It was late at night, but the red light of a fire flickered among the trunks where a creek swirled across the bottom of the valley, and Ledger, who had just flung fresh branches upon it, leaned against the rude windlass at the head of the adjacent shaft. The roar of the river seemed to have sunk to a lower tone that night, and save for its dull reverberations, there was deep silence among the pines across which the fleecy mists were drifting. It seemed to emphasize the harshness of the persistent click of the pick, which broke sharply through the stillness of the night. Ledger was stiff in every joint, and his limbs were aching from a long day's labor. He was also wet with the dew and now and then shivered a little, for the night air was chilled by the snow. But he scarcely noticed this as he listened to the sound of his comrade's toil below. He had not Ingleby's incentive, but it is probable that very few men would have concerned themselves much about weariness or discomfort just then. The shaft they had painfully driven had at last reached, or was very close upon, the ancient riverbed. And now any stroke of the pick might make the result of their labor plain to them. It might be a disastrous failure, or a competence for the rest of their days, and the oldest prospector could have done no more than guess at the probabilities. Placer mining is a gamble, which in the Northwest, at least, man stakes the utmost toil of his body, and often his life, on the chance of finding a very uncertain quantity of the precious metal. At last the tension grew almost unendurable, and Ledger, worn out as he was, felt his courage fail him. His body craved sleep, and he dreaded the answer to the question which had occupied him ceaselessly for the last few days. He felt that it should be unfavorable. He could hardly face it then, and even the harrowing uncertainty was better than a negative. "Come up, Walter, I'm getting cold," he said. There was a harsh laugh below, and a voice that sounded strained and hollow rose from the shaft.
"Then sit by the fire," it said.
"Come up," said Ledger sharply. "If you must have the truth, I've borne about as much as you could expect of me today. We'll probably know the result soon enough."
"I can't wait," said Ingleby.
Ledger said nothing further. He could not leave his comrade there, and he sat down by the windlass with his fingers trembling a little on the pipe he did not light. The faint sighing in the fir tops had died away, and only the noise of man's petty activity ran on, discordant, and it almost seemed presumptuous. A half moon hung above the shoulder of a towering peak, wrapped in a mantle of everlasting white. The river twinkled in the gloom below, but it counted for nothing with Ledger that earth and sky were steeped in a profound serenity. He was sensible only of the jar of the pick below. In the meanwhile, Ingleby, stripped to the waist, toiled feverishly by the light of a few blazing resin knots in the narrow pit. His hands were bleeding, and the dew of effort dripped from him while he swung with a clinking pick like an automaton. He was grimed with mire, his long boots were sodden, and the drip from the shaft side splashed upon his naked shoulders, while his face was grim and gray with the weariness he did not feel, At last there was a sharp ringing as the pick went down, and while his raw hands tingled, he flung the implement aside.
"Bedrock or a boulder," he said hoarsely. "Send the bucket down."
It was a bald announcement, but that was not a time for speech, and Ledger fully realized the significance of it. The crazy windlass rattled, and the rude receptacle of deer hide stretched on a willow hoop came down. Ingleby filled it with a shovel, and then pressed down a further load of sand and soil and pebbles with quivering hands.
"Heave,"
he said sharply. The bucket went up, and it was with a little grim smile. Ingleby struggled into his rent shirt, though the operation cost him at least a minute. There was, he knew, a necessity for keeping his head now, and holding himself in hand by an effort, he crawled slowly up the notched fir pole, lowered into the little shaft. Then he and Ledger, saying nothing, proceeded to the creek with a heavy bucket and a big indurated basin. Ingleby went in knee-deep, with the firelight flickering on him, and with a twirl of his hands washed out half the lighter contents of the basin. Then he glanced at Ledger. "Shall we try it now?" he said.
"No," said Ledger a trifle hoarsely. "Put in the rest."
Ingleby emptied into a little heap what was left in the basin, after which he filled it again and repeated the process several times, while Ledger stood still upon the bank, watching him. Neither said anything, though there was a strained expectancy in their faces that showed the importance of the result. At last there was nothing left in the bucket, and Ledger's hands shook as he scooped up the little heap upon the bank and flung it into the basin.
"Get it done," he said.
Ingleby stepped back into the stream and was busy some little time, tilting and twirling the basin and now and then stirring its contents with his hand. Then he very carefully let the water run away and waded with a curious slowness to the bank. He stood there for a tense moment, while he and Ledger looked at each other, until the latter, turning, stirred the crackling fire.
"Pour it out," he said hoarsely. "I can't stand much more of this."
Ingleby shook out the contents of the basin on a little strip of hide, and for a moment or two could scarcely discern anything, for his heart throbbed painfully, and his sight was a trifle dim. Then he made out that there were little yellow grains scattered about the hide. And when he stirred the fragments of stone and pebbles with his fingers, larger particles of the same hue became visible. He straightened himself slowly with a little gasp, and the blood surged to his face.
"I almost think we struck it rich,"
he said. Ledger said nothing whatever, for there are times when it is difficult to express one's feelings articulately, and he stood quite still in the firelight, blinking at Ingleby. Then he sat down and, scraping the precious grains into a little bag, poised it in his hand.
"There will be no need for any more baking at this rate. We'll go home and tell Hetty," he said.
"She's asleep," said Ingleby, whose voice shook a little.
"Perhaps she is," said Ledger with a curious smile. "I fancy I shall rest tonight."
They climbed the hillside together, Ingleby carrying the little bag, but he scarcely saw the glow of the fire that still burned outside the shanty or the clustering pines. His heart no longer throbbed as it had done. And while a curious lassitude came upon him, alluring visions floated before him. Then as they stopped in front of the shanty, a shadowy figure slipped out of it. And, for the firelight fell upon them, Hetty felt her fingers quiver as she glanced at Ingleby's face.
"Oh,"
she said with a little gasp. You found the gold. Ingleby gravely held out the bag. That is the first of it, and it's yours, he said. If it hadn't been for you, we should never have held the mine. 1/3 of all of it belongs to you. Hetty took the gold with a little smile. I'm very glad you found it and remembered me, she said. Then she turned away somewhat abruptly and went back into the shanty. Hetty scarcely seems as delighted as one would have expected, said Ingleby. Ledger, whose face had grown a trifle grave, laughed in a fashion which suggested that it cost him an effort. One so seldom gets a windfall of this kind that it's a trifle difficult to know how to express one's satisfaction. The only thing that occurs to me is to smash all the cooking utensils, but considering the distance from the settlement, that would scarcely be convenient. Ingleby, who flung himself down beside the fire, made no answer, but vacantly drank the coffee and ate the food that Hetty brought him. He was, in fact, almost oblivious of his surroundings, for again his fancy was busy with alluring visions, and now that the tension was over, his perceptions were dulled by the weariness of his worn-out body. At last, however, he became sensible that Ledger was no longer there, and that Hetty was sitting alone on the opposite side of the sinking fire. "Where's Tom?" he asked. "I think he's asleep," said Hetty. "It's no wonder. Aren't you very tired, Walter?" Ingleby laughed drowsily and stretched his aching limbs. "I really believe I am, though I scarcely felt it until this moment. What are you sitting up for, Hetty?"
"I don't quite know. Still, one doesn't come into a fortune every day. I suppose it is a fortune, Walter."
Ingleby's face grew a trifle grave. "It at least looks like it, but nobody could tell just now. A place or mine often works out unexpectedly."
"Still, if it doesn't, what are you going to do?"
"Why don't you say we?" Hetty smiled curiously and shook her head.
"You will not want Tom and me now."
"If you fancy I would ever be willing to lose sight of either of you, you are doing me a wrong. Haven't I been living on your bounty, on what you made by baking with your own little hands? Would we have found the gold if it hadn't been for you?"
Hetty flushed a little, but she persisted. "I'm not sure the new friends you will make would approve of us," she said.
"Then," said Ingleby decisively, "they will not be friends of mine. You don't seem to understand that you have a third share in the mine and Tom holds another. The result of that will be that you will be able to live as you like and dress as prettily as anybody. Still, don't you think that old print gown, I suppose it is print, you put on to bake in is worth all a court lady's finery?"
Hetty once more shook her head. "I should still be Hetty Ledger, who waited at a boarding house and sold bread to the miners," she said. "If I pretended to be anyone else, people would only find me out and laugh, as well as look down on me. Nothing that I could put on or anyone could teach me would make me quite the same as Miss Colthurst, you see."
Ingleby, who had not expected this, was not exactly pleased. He was very grateful to Hetty, and thought, which was how he expressed it, a good deal of her. But since she had raised the point, there was certainly a difference between her and Grace Colthurst. It did not occur to him that the difference might, after all, be in Hetty's favor, and that there were qualities she possessed which are worth more than many accomplishments and a reposeful manner. In the meanwhile, Hetty appeared to expect an answer, and he felt that she had placed him in a difficulty.
"What you have suggested applies as much to me," he said.
Hetty laughed. "I was wondering what you would say, and I suppose it does. Still, nobody seems to mind the little difference so much in a man.
when he has plenty of money. You are going to marry Miss Coldhurst if you get rich, Walter.
Yes, said Ingleby gravely, if she will have me, which I am afraid is far from certain, but I must make myself more than a placer minor first. That is why, if Tom is willing, I shall probably start a contractor's business and build roads and bridges. They are always wanted in this province, and I fancy making them wouldn't be so very difficult. Tom would stay in the office. He has the brains, you see, and I like the outside life in the bush. It is a useful profession that everybody looks up to here, and we could, of course, bring out a young English engineer.
He had sunk back a little on the pile of branches where he lay, and Hetty noticed that his eyes were heavy, but he roused himself with an effort.
We will go back to Vancouver when the mine works out. You shall choose the house, one of the pretty ones outside the town, with the wooden pillars and painted scrollwork. We will get a China boy to cook for you. You shall have a pair of ponies to drive in Stanley Park. Tom will keep the books and get the orders, while I do the work. Roads and bridges, flumes and dams are always wanted, and I must be more than a placer minor.
Then his head sank forward, and Hetty, who sat still for a minute, rose with a little wistful smile and looked down at him. He lay with eyes quite closed now and one arm stretched out, for the needs of the worn-out body had at last proved stronger than his will. His jacket had fallen open to the waist, and Hetty noticed how thin he was and the hollowness of his quiet face. Then she slipped softly into the tent where Ledger lay asleep, and coming out with a coarse brown blanket, spread it over Ingleby, though as she did it the flickering light showed a rich damask in her cheek. Then laying fresh wood on the fire, she stole away and left him to sleep. The great branches that met above him kept off the dew, and one could sleep as well there as in the tent. The sun had cleared the redwoods when he opened his eyes again and saw Ledger smiling down at him.
It's a very long while since I got up so late, and I don't quite know how I came to be lying here, he said. I suppose I fell asleep beside the fire, but in that case it's a little difficult to understand how I could have got the blanket and tucked myself in. Then he stood up and stretched himself, while Ledger glanced at him curiously.
I don't think it matters very much. You looked half dazed when I left you, and scarcely likely to remember what you did, he said. Breakfast is almost ready, and we have a good deal on hand today. Within the next half hour, they were at work again, and by afternoon had satisfied themselves of the richness of the claim. They also, in accordance with established custom, put up a little flag to show all whom it might concern that they had bottomed on gold. As it happened, nobody but a police trooper who asked them a few questions saw it, for the pines were thick and most of the placer workings situated farther up the valley. The trooper mentioned the matter to Esmond, and the latter forthwith called upon Major Coldhurst. His opportunity had come.
I wonder if you know that your friend Ingleby has struck gold, he said.
I didn't, said Coldhurst, who did not appear to notice his sardonic tone. I'm pleased to hear it. Esmond's smile might have meant anything.
It would, he said, have been wiser if Ingleby had stayed on his claim. You remember that he left it for a considerable time.
I do, said Coldhurst, who glanced at him inquiringly with a trace of dryness. In different circumstances, it might have cost him his title.
Esmond sat silent for a moment or two. So far as I understand, the enactments, one only holds a placer claim on the condition that the work goes on continuously, he said. In the case you are referring to, I believe it did. Ingleby left his partner in possession.
Esmond smiled.
It is, one understands, essential that everybody holding a mineral claim of any kind should have a free miner certificate. Of course, Ingleby and Ledger each took one out. I remember it very well.
All certificates, said Esmond, expire on the 31st of May.
Ingleby renewed his, said Colthurst, and stopped abruptly.
Ingleby, as you remember, invalidated his title.
Colthurst rose sharply and took down his register. He flicked over several pages and closed it with a little bang. Then as he turned to Esmond, his face grew a trifle grim.
I'm not quite sure how far my authority goes until I look it up, he said. I have rather a liking for Ingleby.
Esmond smiled in a deprecatory fashion.
It is not exactly my business, but one would fancy that you couldn't very well discriminate, sir. Anything of the kind would have an undesirable effect upon the other men.
That is my affair, and Colthurst glanced at him sharply. It is a little difficult to understand why you raised the question only when they had found the gold.
I fancy that it is very natural, sir. It is no part of my duty to see the mining regulations are carried out, and it was not until I heard they had struck the lead that I remembered the little fact I noticed. In looking over your register, it seemed advisable to let you know. The men seem inclined to find fault with everything just now, and if it came out that Ingleby's claim had not been sequestrated when it should have been, then they might get it into their heads that you had winked at the irregularity because you were on good terms with him. That would naturally increase my difficulties with them.
Colthurst stood looking at him with a hardening face.
I am, he said, very sorry that this has happened, but it will be gone into. May I trouble you to send one of your troopers over for Ingleby and Ledger?
Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaw.